this time on your weekly Constitutional.
Most people today, when you say, what are the contributions of Abraham Lincoln? They say he saved the Union and he freed the slaves. Those things did happen. But when you drill down a little deeper to ask for the reasons for both of those things, they're quite different than what most people think of.
Today we'll speak with Dr. Charles Hubbard, a historian at Lincoln Memorial University and a specialist on Abraham Lincoln. He's a director, in fact, of the Abraham Lincoln Institute for the Study of Leadership and Public Policy and the author of several books on Lincoln and the Civil War. Why did Lincoln fight so hard to preserve the Union? It's a fascinating tale, and Charlie Hubbard's going to tell us all about it. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week, it's Why Did Lincoln Save the Union?
Stay tuned for your weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. And it's starting now.
Charles Hubbard is a professor of history at Lincoln Memorial University and the executive director of the Abraham Lincoln Institute for the Study of Leadership and Public Policy. He's also a colleague and friend of mine, and he's one of the most delightful people I've met since I started working at Lincoln Memorial University's School of Law. He's written so many books and won so many awards, I can't mention them all, but I'll simply mention that back in 2009, on the 200th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's birth, he was one of the Distinguished Lincoln Scholars to receive a special Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial edition of the Order of Lincoln, the highest honor bestowed by the state of Illinois. He's quite a guy, and today he's going to tell us all about something that might have slipped your mind, something that you might have overlooked. While the South fought the Civil War, while it started the Civil War to preserve slavery, why did Abraham Lincoln respond in kind? Why did he go to war? Well, he didn't talk a lot about slavery, not at that point in the war. What he talked about was preserving the Union. Why? Why didn't he care so much about preserving the Union? Why didn't he just let the South go? Charlie Hubbard will tell us all about it.
My name is Charles Hubbard, and I am a professor of history at Lincoln Memorial University, and I'm the director of the Abraham Lincoln Institute for Leadership and Foreign Policy.
Really? Tell me about that institute.
Well, the Institute was set up a few years ago by Lincoln Memorial University to focus attention on Lincoln as an example of ethical but yet practical leadership and public policy. Since then, we have been sponsoring a series of lectures and to introduce Lincoln into the academic world. In a more formal sort of way.
Right. I think our regular listeners have already experienced a little bit of your activities then, because Dan Farber did a McMurtry lecture last year, and he sat right where you're sitting right now and told us.
I'm flattered.
Dan's a great guy, and he had a lot of interesting things to say, but I'm sure you will as well. But before we leave the subject of the Institute, let me just say that I very much applaud the idea of focusing upon public policy. Because while academic research and writing are all very important in their own right, I certainly have a bias toward civic responsibility, civic engagement, civic virtue. That's what this show's all about. And so taking the lessons of Lincoln's life and implementing them in the real world, that's a very worthy endeavor.
I think, yes, I certainly agree with that. And I think that Lincoln brought a certain ethical a real down-to-earth, pragmatic sense of ethical principles that shaped, in many ways, his administration, his presidency, and even in his practice of law. Mm-hmm. Ethics, his personal ethic and his professional ethic often came into conflict, and it's always been fascinating to me, and I'm sure you've done more with this than I have, but it's always been a subject of real interest to me, is how Lincoln the lawyer reconciled his personal beliefs, for example, on slavery, with the law. How could he then go forward and represent a slave owner at the same time he was fundamentally opposed to slavery?
That's a problem every lawyer has, is that you have to, on the one hand, recognize that In some sense, every client deserves zealous representation. And you recognize that you'll occasionally have clients with particular tasks or cases that you don't particularly like, you don't particularly approve of. And yet there's the practical imperative. I mean, you need work. You need clients to pay the bills. I mean, there's always that conflict. But even beyond that, there's just the conflict between your professional responsibility to do a good job on the one hand and your personal reactions to people. And certainly, I think back on my own career, and I represented, I won't mention any names, but I represented some people that I don't know that I personally would want to have associated with. And I represented them in some matters that occasionally I didn't really feel good about after the fact. Fortunately, I was able to disengage myself from those circumstances, but it's a continuing problem. I mean, for every lawyer in private practice and even those who work for in the public realm, you know, what if you are a lawyer at the Department of Justice and you don't happen to agree with what the president wants to do? Not saying that's happening right now, but I mean, certainly those conflicts exist. And so that is fascinating. And, you know, ethics are important, but the real test of how ethical you are comes in actual life, doesn't it?
Yes, and I think Lincoln provides us and that's why I toss in the word, you know, when I talk about ethics, practical, pragmatic practice of one can exercise fundamentally and believe in without abandoning your basic principles, but you still are forced to be pragmatic in your approach to making a public policy. For example.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wish you well in the work of the Institute. But today, we're going to focus more specifically on Lincoln himself. It's very difficult with you. I'll have to actually say this, Charlie. It's very difficult with you to figure out what to focus on because you have such an encyclopedic knowledge of this extraordinarily important man. But in our discussion earlier today, you mentioned something about Lincoln's Constitution. And how we are really living in the world that Lincoln, in some sense, created, which brought me to the more fundamental question and one that I've puzzled about ever since I was a little kid. You know, why did Lincoln do what he did? Why was it so important for him to protect the Union, which was, of course, his first reason for pursuing the Civil War, for fighting the Civil War, long before slavery came to the fore with the Emancipation Proclamations. Why did Lincoln think it was so important not to let the South secede from the Union?
Well, I think that Lincoln believed in democracy, a democratic rule of the majority. And he was elected president of the United States. And interestingly enough, Lincoln only received 39% of the popular vote.
That's remarkable.
In the election of 1860. Mm-hmm. Now, he got more popular votes than, he got a majority of those votes cast, but in the total of the popular vote, he only got 39%, but he won in the Electoral College overwhelmingly. So there was, to say the least, a very divided country, and in fact, the Republican Party was fairly new, just a few years old, and Lincoln was only the second presidential candidate after John C. Fremont to run for president on the as a Republican. Mm-hmm. And Lincoln felt that he represented the country, because he represented the total country, and that included those people who did not vote for him, he wanted to save the Union because if secession was allowed to proceed and the Southern states were allowed to withdraw, slavery was not the basic fundamental reason that Lincoln wanted to save the Union. He would have, and he said, that if I could save the Union and free all of the slaves, I would. Some of the slaves, I would. Or none of the slaves, I would.
So it was all about Union. It was not about slavery.
So it's all at this point.
Right, right.
I'm speaking now of 1860, 61, during mm-hmm. that winter crisis. And what I think your question is, what motivated Lincoln to place saving the Union high on the list. Most people today, when you say, what are the contributions of Abraham Lincoln? They say he saved the Union and he freed the slaves. Those things did happen. But they don't, when you drill down a little deeper to ask for the reasons for both of those things, they're quite different than what most people think of. Now, why did he save the Union? What that to your question. Lincoln felt that if the Southern states seceded, it would destroy what he called the last best hope on earth. And for him, that was representative democratic government, the rule of the majority. Now, for Lincoln, the rule of the majority required the submission of a minority. And in this case, the South was a minority. They had not voted for him, and they were going to leave the Union. And when you had Daniel Farber here, Farber talks about saving the Union and changing the structure of the Union because, in his view, the Constitution changes and becomes Lincoln's Constitution. Mm-hmm. And it's the federal system that's modified, in Farber's view, to take away state sovereignty or any approach to state sovereignty and create the national unity that Lincoln accomplishes. Now, I would go further and say that Lincoln saves democracy and the rule of the majority by forcing a minority to submit to the rule of the majority. Democracy collapses completely if the minority is not willing to submit to the will of the majority.
That is, in some sense, such a self-evident statement. But on the other hand, it's profound. It's something that I think people often forget. We have a democratic system, or as lawyers might call it, a majoritarian system. The majority rules. Now, we modify that to some extent by saying that there are certain rights.
It's sort of fettered democracy.
It's fettered democracy. But by and large, we, even though people, the purists will say, well, we're really a democratic republic. Okay, fine. But we're not talking about those structural issues. We're talking about the basic concept of majority rule.
Exactly.
You got 10 people in a room. It takes 6 to make a majority. And if that's what the vote is on any important issue, there are going to be 4 very disappointed people in that room.
And do they leave the room?
Exactly. That's the question. I mean, those 4 people have to be willing to stay in that room and submit to the will of the majority, even though they may vehemently disagree with it, or the whole system breaks down.
Exactly.
And that's what the Southern states were talking about. They were the 4 people who wanted to leave the room because they felt that the issue in that particular point was slavery, was so important to their economic existence, their way of life, their values, that it was a breaking point for them. But it could have been some other issue. It could have been some other issue that was as important.
And would have been.
It could have been.
Because the domestic agenda that the Republican Party was pushing through, we could talk about that another time maybe, but that domestic agenda was also repugnant to most Southern, particularly the Southern aristocracy, the slaveholding class.
Well, before we leave that, though, I want to emphasize, we're not saying that the Civil War was not about slavery.
Exactly.
Of course it was. That was
secession.
What caused...
Secession was about slavery.
Right. Slavery caused secession. Secession then caused the Civil War. So we're not denying that in any way, shape, or form. But what we're focusing on is the idea of preserving the Union and calling our country the last best hope of humanity. Really went to that fundamental question. Can a democratic government survive? It can only survive if the people who lose the vote are willing to stick around. And we see that right now. I mean, the people who lost this election, this past election in 2016, the Democrats are beside themselves. I have never seen people so depressed and upset and talking about moving to Canada and all the rest of the things that people are talking about. And they are absolutely beside themselves. But guess what? Very few, if any, have actually moved to Canada. Okay, they haven't seceded in their own individual capacity as citizens. They're sticking around and they're looking to the next election.
They have faith that the ballot box, the ballot will ultimately prevail. They can vote. The minority can become a majority.
And is that
now,
faith?
One of the things that's important, though, when we are talking about this, Lincoln also understood that the majority in a democracy is required to protect the rights of the dissenters or the minority.
Mm-hmm.
they have to be considered. Their positions have to, and their right to protest and their right to vote.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're speaking with Dr. Charles Hubbard of Lincoln Memorial University, all about why Abraham Lincoln wanted so badly to save the Union. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Charlie Hubbard. Stick around. And now it's time for another constitutional quiz recorded at Vilnius University in Lithuania. Well, I'm looking at you, and I'm thinking Kazakhstan.
Yes.
Yes. What is your name?
My name is Asiem.
Asiem?
Mm-hmm.
Well, look at that. I could pronounce that. And where are you from, Asiem?
I'm from Kazakhstan.
Where about in Kazakhstan? Where?
I'm from the capital city, Astana. Astana. Capital.
Okay. I'll pronounce that one of these days. Very good. Okay. That's a long way away.
Yes.
That's a couple thousand miles, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's not part of the European Union, is it?
No, it's not.
Okay, but you're still an Erasmus student.
Kind of.
Kind of an Erasmus student, I see. And so you are coming to Europe, and you're meeting all sorts of people from other countries, and you have one classmate with you that we've spoken with. And tell me about your experience. Are you enjoying yourself here in Lithuania?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I really like this time. It's really great experience. I'm really happy that I'm here.
How is it different from Kazakhstan? Is it?
It was kind of different because here's like a lot of European people. But as you know, the older population can speak on Russian. And
right.
I can speak on Russian too.
You know, that's the funny thing is I was thinking you sound like you have a Russian accent.
Maybe.
Because Kazakhstan has long been associated with Russia and with the Soviet Union. It's now an independent nation,
now,
right?
Yes.
That's right. But still, most people from Kazakhstan, you call yourselves Kazakhs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so most Kazakhs can speak Russian?
Mostly. More on the north of Kazakhstan because it's really close to Russia.
Right.
So, but other parts are not so good at Russian.
Right.
But north part are mostly speaking Russian.
Where did you learn English? Your English is so good.
Thank you. I started learning English in school.
Right.
So we are learning English too in schools.
And so you speak Kazakh, you speak Russian, you speak English. Do you speak anything else?
Maybe some words on Spanish and German.
Right.
And a bit Lithuanian, of course.
A bit of Lithuanian, of course. I mean, absolutely, of course. Well, I can understand that. Well, and you're studying in this class, you're studying the American legal system.
Yes.
Are you going to be a lawyer?
Yes.
Really? And are you going to practice back in Kazakhstan?
I hope.
What kind of law do you think you'd like to practice?
Mostly international law.
International law. Is there a lot of international trade going on in Kazakhstan?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What sort of things do you sell? I mean, do you have oil or do you have what other products?
We have oil.
Mm-hmm.
We are producing oil. But it's kind of political question because we have a lot of oil in our country. We have other like things in the earth, but we cannot produce them by ourselves. That's why we hire other people from other countries, and they're producing it and like selling for us.
Right. And so that's where you need international lawyers. Well, it sounds like a growth industry. Good for you. Okay, let's talk a little bit about what you've learned in this class. We like to talk about our Constitution as protecting our freedom and our liberty. Was that always true? Did our Constitution always protect everybody's freedom and liberty?
Not so much, maybe. Because originally, in original Constitution, didn't protect. Didn't protect, but it's kind of protected more slavers.
Right,
maybe.
The slave owners,
yes.
Right. Right, in fact, there were only white men at our Constitutional Convention. When did women get the vote in the United States? Do you know?
1920,
yeah. So not everybody was protected all that time. Did women get to vote in Kazakhstan?
Yes.
Well, I'm glad for you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much for taking our quiz. You've done very well. So we'll send you a T-shirt. Make sure Professor Harris has your address and your T-shirt size, and we will send you one of these things. And all the boys in Kazakhstan will look at you when you wear your T-shirt.
Thank you.
All right. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week our guest is Charles Hubbard, a professor of history at Lincoln Memorial University and a specialist in all matters Lincoln. In fact, he's the executive director of the Abraham Lincoln Institute for the Study of Leadership and Public Policy. Before the break, Charlie was telling us all about the very nature of democracy and the important things that it requires of us in order for democracy to flourish. Abraham Lincoln understood those things. Abraham Lincoln felt that the United States was the last best hope for self-government. This was especially true right in the middle of the war in the election of 1864.
Now, in the midst of civil war and a divided country, could Lincoln have postponed the election? Certainly he could have. Could he said, we're not in a position, the whole country, we're not able to get everybody to vote. We're not able to run a real comprehensive kind of all-inclusive election. So let's just postpone this until the war is over and I'll continue as president. Lincoln didn't say that because the Constitution provided every 4 years we're going to have a presidential election. And Lincoln said, and he really thought before the September, really, of 64, he really thought he was going to lose the election.
To McClellan.
To McClellan, yes.
Yeah.
Popular opinion was going against him because the war news was favorable finally. They were winning battles. They were occupying the South. But the casualty list continued to mount.
Mm-hmm.
And the country was becoming, as we have seen in other times, very war-weary, very tired of looking at the post office door to see relatives and friends dead in the war, killed in the war. For what purpose? To save those people we don't like anyway,
mm-hmm.
to keep them in the Union that don't want to be here. Why are we doing this? Lincoln got above that and said the reason we're doing it is to save democracy, to save popular representative government.
And it would have been a little inconsistent for him to have canceled or postponed elections.
Exactly.
But he was willing to do so, and that's the other part of it.
And take the consequences if
he
lost.
And take the consequences. So it's not just the minority that has to be willing to submit to the majority. It's the majority that has to continue to respect the rights of the minority. In fact, the rights of everyone.
And protect them.
To continue to participate. And again, I don't want to make this about current politics, but I think a little bit of that would go a long way today if people would remember whether they happen to be in the majority or the minority.
I think people are entitled, and they did in Lincoln's time, entitled to protest. The press, for example, mm-hmm. often blasted Lincoln.
Right.
And the same thing was true in the South. The Southern press often and regularly blasted and assailed Jefferson Davis. And they have the right to do that.
Yeah.
We have the right in our free democracy to disagree.
So things were looking bad in 1864.
Bad in a different sort of way than they looked earlier in the war.
Right.
When it looked like the South might win.
Yeah.
And the South probably never really had a chance to win in a prolonged war, one of attrition. They didn't have the resources, and they didn't have the manpower, and we could go into that. But we're talking about Lincoln, not necessarily. They felt, the South, Confederacy, felt like they had to win a defensive war. And if they could do that. And Lincoln, at the beginning, felt that if we can have one or two big decisive battles, we will take away the will of the South to fight. Reality will come to pass. Well, that didn't work. The casualties continued to mount. What made him so unpopular? As the 64 election, with the electorate, at least in his view, at that point, was that the country had become so tired of the war
mm-hmm.
and the cost of the war, the horrific cost of the war. People were saying peace at almost any price.
Right. And let those people go. If they want to go,
and,
just let them go.
If people who've seen the Lincoln movie, you mm-hmm. can always rely on Hal Holbrook to present the piece at any cost, because he had sons in the war, and he'd already lost one son in the
right.
war. And people like Crittenden from Kentucky had a son fighting on both sides in the war. And so the war, these people were tired, and they wanted peace. And here comes McClellan offering peace, but with the Union intact.
Right.
And slavery intact, that sprang these Southerners back into the Union, and let's keep slavery if that's what we have to do.
Right. Basically go back to the status quo ante. McClellan, of course, Civil War buffs will remember, had been Lincoln's first general and had been notoriously reluctant to be aggressive in his prosecution of the war. And eventually this led Lincoln to fire him and replace him with a series of commanders until, of course, eventually he settled upon Grant a bit later in the war. But McClellan didn't just fade away. McClellan then became an outspoken critic of Lincoln and became the nominee of the Democratic Party.
He was always an outspoken critic of Lincoln.
Right.
Even when he was a general,
right.
He was insubordinate beyond anybody's description. But he failed. Anyway, that's a discussion for another time. But McClellan certainly represented that peace movement, not to the extent that the Copperheads, people like Van Landingham and other people, were capitulators, more or less. But McClellan wasn't that. McClellan was a strong Unionist, but he wanted to end the war by protecting slavery if necessary.
Right.
Not that he favored it, but he always, throughout, even when he was a general, he thought that we shouldn't destroy the South. Because they are part of the country and they are a viable part of our economic structure, and their system is somewhat different than we have in other parts of the country, but nevertheless, it's a valid system. So he was not, he had known Lincoln for a lot longer than that, because he was president of the Illinois Central Railroad when Lincoln was the general counsel for the Illinois Central Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, McClellan had lent his private railroad car to Stephen Douglas when they were running, both men were running for the Senate seat in Illinois to campaign against Lincoln. And so he'd never really been a friend, so to speak, of Lincoln. And they were very different in their approach.
But to bring it back to the focus of our discussion then, Lincoln was willing, in the election of 1864, knowing McClellan as he did, knowing him intimately for a number of years, and realizing his vision for the future was very different from Lincoln's own. Because Lincoln, of course, in his heart of heart, was an abolitionist. I mean, he was a person who was very much against slavery. You're shaking your head. No, I'm wrong?
I would say Lincoln would never have admitted to being an abolitionist.
But now you're telling me something here that doesn't comport with what I've always thought. I always thought he was very anti-slavery.
He anti-slavery.
Okay, but that's not
but
the
that's
same thing.
That's not an abolitionist.
Oh, okay. Then correct me. Tell me what I've...
In a difference, maybe we're speaking here a little bit about definitions of words, maybe.
Right.
And maybe we're picking at the thing a little bit. But an abolitionist was a person who wanted to abolish slavery without conditions immediately. Lincoln wanted to abolish slavery or to do away with slavery, but he was practical in the sense that he didn't think it was politically possible.
Or constitutionally possible before the war,
that's right? Without changing the Constitution. And people say that the Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves. No, it didn't.
Right. Well, we'll get to that in just a moment. But that's the important thing to remember here. And thank you for correcting me, because you're right. I overstated it when I said he was an abolitionist. But he was very anti-slavery.
Yes.
So McClellan represented an extremely different perspective, and one that Lincoln abhorred. And yet, Lincoln was willing to submit their two conflicting views of the future to the electorate, because that, in his mind, was what this was all about. It was majority rules. And if he'd lost that election in 1864, he would have packed up his stovepipe hat and gone back to Illinois.
That's
and
right.
Then McClellan would have been running the executive, and the history would have been very, very different.
It's kind of
That's the important thing. He was willing to be a loser, and he was willing in advance to say, I'm going to submit to the will of the majority.
Because he thought that was the last best hope on earth.
Exactly.
Majority rule. Government by the people.
government by the people, again, to coin a phrase. Okay, that's, to me, that helps me to understand why this union thing was so important. He really felt the United States was special. He really believed in the American experiment in self-government, and he was willing to put everything on the line to defend that.
And is it really still an experiment?
Every day.
Yeah. And as it we as experiments go, we discover volatile components, possibly, to the experiment. Mm-hmm. And maybe in today's environment, as you mentioned earlier, maybe we are a little bit more radical on both sides than we have in times gone by. But look at all the 1960s, for example. Look at all of the dissent, all mm-hmm. the protests, you know, people marching around the White House with their signs chanting, LBJ, LBJ, how many boys did you kill today?
Yeah.
You know, the anti-war movement. Then we have the backlash, the conservative backlash that the Republicans ran against the liberal establishment with Barry Goldwater. Mm-hmm. And You look at all of these ebb and flows, and it seems that radicals of one sort or another are always out there. And we identify them as radicals, but really probably all they are is interested, concerned, informed, and aggressive people mm-hmm. participating in the system and governing themselves.
Well, I hear a lot of talk, and I've heard it, as you point out, over the last few decades as well, when things have been particularly divisive, and people will reject the very idea of democracy, and they'll even talk about resorting to violence in some cases. I always try to shut that discussion down if it's in my position to do so, and I simply say, don't be talking that way. Okay, that undercuts our very system. Talk about the next election. Okay, you don't like the guy who got elected, that's fine.
Lincoln said that the ballot box is more powerful than the bullet. Mm-hmm. If you want to change, use the ballot. If you won't change, use the ballot, not the bullet.
Right.
And an interesting thing about McClellan, after the Battle of Antietam. Shortly after that, Lincoln made the decision to remove McClellan.
Mm-hmm. This was early. This was in 1862. Right.
Yeah. And he made the decision to remove McClellan. Well, there was talk in McClellan's staff about marching on Washington and taking over the government.
Really?
And McClellan stifled that.
Well, good
said,
for him.
We are not going to have that, and censured a couple of his officers for that conversation. It never came to be a big public issue, but it clearly was a feeling among some of his staff people that McClellan would have been a better leader. A military person needed to be in charge rather than a civilian. Which is another interesting thing. Here's Lincoln, a civilian commander-in-chief in a time of war. And, of course, we always have that. I mean, mm-hmm. our military is always going to be ultimately controlled by a civilian elected person, the commander-in-chief.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting that McClellan would believe the same thing, the Union first.
Well, you've told me something I didn't know. In fact, that's very inspiring. It speaks very well of McClellan. And it reminds me of that famous incident at the Newburgh Barracks with George Washington, when he was confronted with a group of his officers who were talking about marching on the Confederation Congress and taking the money that was owed them for their pay. And he came in and said, this ain't going to happen, guys. Mm-hmm. And broke it up.
And the Whiskey Rebellion's another time. They wanted to do a revolt, and
right.
Washington just said, no, I'll take the militia out there, and we'll enforce the law.
Right.
And as soon as Washington took to the field, the rebels decided that they had too much respect for George Washington.
I always felt a little bit sorry for the Whiskey Rebellion leaders. George Washington is coming at the head of an army.
That's because you wanted to buy cheap whiskey.
I just thought about that. Here comes George Washington on his horse. I'm getting out of here. Yeah, I mean, this is going nowhere. Okay, but that's really what it takes. It takes, a willingness to submit if you're in the minority, a willingness to respect the rights of the minority if you're in the majority, a willingness to defend with force, if necessary, the democracy, an ability to resist the temptation to take things by force if you're in a position to do so, if you're a military leader. So we've seen several examples then of that sort of thing.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I am Stuart Harrison. Don't worry, we're not quite finished with our interview with Dr. Charles Hubbard of Lincoln Memorial University. He's telling us all about Abraham Lincoln, and we're even talking about the very nature of democracy itself. After the break, we'll come back and we'll finish our discussion with Charlie Hubbard. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Charles Hubbard, a professor of history at Lincoln Memorial University and the executive director of the Abraham Lincoln Institute for the Study of Leadership and Public Policy. Charlie knows what he's talking about. He's written several books, including three on Lincoln and his era, The Many Faces of Lincoln, The Burden of Confederate Diplomacy, and finally, Lincoln and His Contemporaries. Charlie and I are talking about why Abraham Lincoln placed such an emphasis on saving the Union.
This really gave me a much better, more fundamental understanding of why Lincoln did what he did early in the war and why he made that very controversial comment about wanting to save the Union so much that he would do it even if he had to do it and preserve slavery. That's sometimes taken out of context and people will say, oh, look at Lincoln, he was in favor of slavery. Of course he wasn't. He was very anti-slavery, but he was emphasizing that even if he had to accept that bitter pill, the Union was what this war was all about, as far as he was concerned.
And two interesting things, I think, that might be worth pointing out here in this discussion, and that is that statement about if I could free all the slaves, I would, or none of the slaves, I would, to preserve the Union. Lincoln had already written his preliminary Emancipation Proclamation out and had it in a desk drawer when he made that statement. And he made that statement in a letter explaining a larger approach to saving the Union. Is what he was. That whole thing was about saving the Union. But he already had come to the conclusion that slavery had to go for the Union to be saved. And that's why we get the Emancipation Proclamation as a military necessity, unconstitutional, clearly. And Lincoln feared if that ever gets to the Supreme Court, it'll be overturned.
Mm-hmm.
So he issues it, his proclamation, as a military necessity.
Article 2 power, exactly right. But you've drawn a very important relationship here. I've been trying throughout this entire conversation to separate preserving the Union from abolishing slavery, two different things. But you've pointed out something. Saving the Union in the short term may be something they were going to do by force of arms. But saving the Union permanently, once the war was over,
had to be without slavery.
Had to be without slavery, and that goes all the way back to his House Divided speech.
It goes all the way back, yes, to that speech, but it also goes back to what you said earlier, and that is that the war was about slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln understood that, but he's got to save the Union. But to save the Union, he has to do away with slavery. Otherwise, we got the same problem that we had before we started.
Right.
The country's so divided over this issue that one group wants to separate.
So we got to resolve this issue one way or the other.
And we can save the Union by force. But what have we saved if we haven't changed the political structure, if we haven't changed the Constitution? And he does that.
We talked about the Emancipation Proclamation before in this program. We've talked about the issue of slavery on several occasions. My understanding is that emancipation started happening organically, simply as a matter of contraband of war. I mean, the Northern troops
had two confiscation acts.
Exactly. I mean, tell me about that, because I don't really know as much about it as I'd like to. But the Northern armies are heading, for the most part, into the South. I mean, there was that one enormous exception when Lee came north to Gettysburg.
Well, it came into Maryland, too.
I mean,
if you want to call Maryland, it was a free state.
Right, it was right on the border.
At Antietam.
Right.
And he made two, and certainly Braxton Bragg moved into Eastern Kentucky
right.
early in the war. So,
but for the most part, it was the Northern armies heading into the South.
Oh, okay, cool.
Okay. And whenever they did that, they were encountering slaves. And slaves were sometimes captured. Sometimes slaves were running away and came to the Union lines. Practical question. What do you do with those slaves? If you're a Union commander, what do you do with those slaves? And early on in the war, individual commanders were saying, we're not giving you your slaves back because all you're going to do is put them to work.
Well, and actually, the first attempt at that probably very early in the war was John C. Fremont mm-hmm. in Missouri. And he said, in my district, all the slaves will be free.
He was the military governor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm going to emancipate the slaves. He wasn't a military governor. He was a commander of that region.
Right, because Missouri didn't actually...
was a divided state.
Exactly, right.
Yeah. So he said he was going to free the slaves in his jurisdiction. And Lincoln said, no, you're not. I'm the only one who can do that. And stopped that. There was a big controversy over that. And another incident, General Hunter was in South Carolina, and he'd made some inroads along the coast. And slaves, South Carolina slave owners, transported the male slaves toward the interior of South Carolina, away from the Union lines. And they left many of the women and children. So the women and children began to run toward and flee slavery to run toward the Union lines under the command of General Hunter. David Hunter. And Hunter said, we will arm the slaves and we will free them. And Lincoln said, no, and you can't do that. And Hunter said, the slave catchers are mounting their horses and riding these women and children down and shooting them.
Ooh.
And he said, I'm not going to allow that, Mr. President. And Lincoln sent back word, you can't free them, but you can leave them with their arms. You can give them some guns.
That's a compromise. Practical compromise. Uh-huh.
But the Congress is going to eventually pass two confiscation acts, which says these are contraband. We can deprive these slaveholders of their property,
right.
including slaves. But then what are we going to do? We're going to put them to work with us
right.
on the Union side, building fortifications and doing things of that sort. And so that sort of worked.
Right. And as horrible as it is to use such language, that is how the Southerners, at least, viewed the slaves as property. And they were basically labor, and they were going to use them in their war-making efforts. And so there's a certain logic to this. No, we're not going to return your slaves because you'll just use them to fight us and or to produce other commodities for your economy, and we're simply not going to let you do that.
Or to build fortifications, or to build forts, or,
exactly.
or repair the railroad, or any of that sort of thing.
So this sort of stuff was happening. And sometimes local commanders overstepped their bounds by making proclamations, et cetera. But I think a lot of this just happened informally. The slaves came. They were behind the Union lines. Effectively,
well, of course,
they were free.
Of course, for David Hunter and in the Carolina coastal region, by the time the communications could go to Washington and come back, he'd solved the problem on the ground. So,
right.
So, you know, he was... But the point here is that Lincoln was not about to free the slaves in 61.
Right.
So he didn't know how to do that constitutionally. And
he was also afraid about states like Maryland and Kentucky and Missouri. In fact, one great story I heard was that a group of abolitionists came to Lincoln once and said that if he would free the slaves in the loyal states, that God would be on his side, and he supposedly responded, I'd love to have God on my side, gentlemen, but I must have Kentucky and Missouri.
Well, that was Kentucky, uh-huh. and the reason he had was the river network.
Right.
The river network that comes down from Kentucky through central Tennessee.
Sure. So there's a circumstance where he's being practical. He knows he cannot free slaves that are in loyal states because that could push them into the arms of the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, he's very anti-slavery. He hates the institution, but he's got to live with it throughout the war until the war is over.
But when Union control, military control, when the Union Army takes control
right.
of Kentucky and Tennessee, central Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
he's in a position then to use the army, if necessary, to protect freed slaves. So he's able then, out of military necessity, to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, which actually doesn't free very many slaves.
Because it's only in territories that are still in rebellion.
That's right.
Right.
And it specifically exempts certain states. For example, Tennessee is one.
Mm-hmm.
Kentucky is one.
Why?
Because he's not going to free those slaves. He doesn't have the power to do that. You can't, out of military necessity, I can't very well free the slaves where they're already still in the Union.
Mm-hmm.
Or under Union
control in the case of Tennessee, right?
And in the case of Tennessee, he's going to appoint Andrew Johnson as a military governor,
mm-hmm.
and tell Johnson to free the slaves, call a constitutional convention. Johnson does that, and they vote the wrong way. And so he then says, that constitutional convention won't work. We're going to do another one. We're going to keep doing this till we get what Lincoln wants.
Right. Exactly. And eventually, didn't Johnson free the slaves in the state of Tennessee mm-hmm. a little bit in advance of the Emancipation Proclamation?
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating and complex character as well. We've done an episode on Andrew Johnson. But to get back to our focus here then, so slavery, of course, is ultimately the fundamental root cause of the war. Lincoln doesn't defend the Union on that basis originally, but eventually comes to realize that the country can't exist half slave and half free, and so he's going to have to do some kind of emancipation, but he goes very carefully, step by step. He doesn't let his military commanders get too far ahead of him. Then he comes up with a preliminary Emancipation Proclamation in the fall of 1862.
True.
Basically saying, I'm going to do this. Look what I'm going to do. And then on the 1st of January of 1863,
He says, though, if you people will come back into the Union before the first of the year, the Emancipation Proclamation won't be issued.
So you get to keep your slaves.
But, of course, they're not coming back.
Of course, they didn't come back and do it. Isn't that remarkable? Even that late in the war, and the war's been going on for well over a year at that point, he's saying that, if you're willing to come back, we'll let you keep your slaves. We're not going to abolish slavery where it exists.
Well, the Emancipation Proclamation won't be... The final Emancipation Proclamation will not be issued.
Right. But then, of course, they don't. They keep mm-hmm. fighting, and that's when the Emancipation...
Well, we have to mention here, you have to mention the 13th Amendment.
Right.
Before we conclude this discussion about that, because without the 13th Amendment, the Union could not have been saved, in my view,
mm-hmm.
because as soon as it was saved, there would have been another rebellion.
Right.
It would have started over again.
And the 13th Amendment, of course, was not adopted until 1865.
That's true.
But it was in process long before that. So tell us a little bit about that and what Lincoln's role was in that.
Well, Lincoln is, once he's reelected, he's in a good, strong position. But Congress was in this, particularly the House of Representatives, was in this sort of state of lame duck status between the November election and the swearing in of these new people, new House members in the spring. And many of them were not going to come back. They had lost, but they were still able to vote. So Lincoln wants to take advantage of this situation and get the House of Representatives to pass the 13th Amendment, which would abolish slavery in the whole country. And it is the 13th Amendment that abolished slavery and therefore freed the slaves once and for all. And Lincoln's role in that was, that's one of the, there are several times he does this, but not frequently. Lincoln gets involved with Congress. William Harris from North Carolina State has just written a very interesting book on Lincoln and the Congress. And he goes about discussing several of these major issues. And one of the most interesting parts of the book, for me at least, is how Lincoln maneuvers around to get the 13th Amendment passed by putting all kinds of pressure on these lame duck congressmen. Mm-hmm. He even makes some of them convert from one political party to another before they go back home for to run for election. Mm. So all of this is, and he promises some of these candidates that have been defeated, they're still able to vote, a position in the government. Doesn't really officially promise them that, but we'll find you a place here in the government so you'll have a job, but you got to vote for this amendment. That kind of pressure, people say, is unethical. But it was pushing the envelope, to say the least.
He pulled out the stops because at that point he realized that that was the last important thing that needed to be done.
To save the union.
It all goes back to the union.
So was it a moral issue for Lincoln, an ethical issue to free the slaves, or was it a pragmatic political move to save the last best hope on earth? Interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Where do you come down on it?
I would say that Lincoln probably saw slavery as an evil, and certainly his second inaugural address calls it a great sin, so to paraphrase, on all of American society. All of us are responsible for this. And this is God's punishment for us. This crucible of war has been mm-hmm. God's punishment for us.
Mm-hmm.
In the second inaugural, Ron White, who we had down here at Lincoln Memorial last year, talked about, he called that second inaugural Lincoln's Sermon on the Mount, his greatest speech. And in that, Lincoln says, we as a country are collectively responsible for this evil of slavery. So to that extent, Lincoln comes around to seeing it as a moral issue. If he wasn't there at the beginning of the war, he certainly was at the end. But where I come down on it is, again, pragmatic, practical. An opportunity was presented during the war to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. Lincoln seized on that opportunity, and the consequences of that would be played out later.
Well, Dr. Charles Hubbard of Lincoln Memorial University and of the Abraham Lincoln Institute
for Leadership and Public Policy.
Thank you so very much for sharing just a tiny slice of your wisdom with us. And will you come back in the future and share some more?
Oh, absolutely. This is fun.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Charlie Hubbard of Lincoln Memorial University for sharing his wisdom all about Abraham Lincoln and why he went to war. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check him out on SoundCloud. I'm Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.